The Nazis. This book is written for people who are already informed on the European side of World War II and the immediately preceding years. We have no intention of reviewing the nature of the Nazi state, the roles of Goering, Himmler, Goebbels, etc., or the anti-Jewish measures that were taken prior to the war, except that these matters will be touched upon here and there as a matter of course. The major events and approximate dates associated with the war are assumed known by the reader. When Europe was dominated by the Germans, it was not organized according to the plan of the Treaty of Versailles. Figure 3 contained in the print and ebook editions of this book, presents a map of Europe as it was organized in the autumn of 1942, at the apex of Hitler's power. Germany had annexed Austria, Alsace-Lorraine, part of Czechoslovakia, and a great deal of Poland, more than just the part that had been taken from Germany after World War I. The part of Poland that remained was called the General Government, and had the status of a subject province governed by the Germans, as did the three Baltic states of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. In the same subject status were White Russia, the Ukraine, Bohemia-Moravia, formerly Western Czechoslovakia, and Banat, long a part of Hungary dominated by ethnic Germans. The eastern part of Czechoslovakia had become the independent state of Slovakia, and Yugoslavia had been reorganized as Croatia and Serbia, corresponding to the two dominant of the five nationalities that had constituted Yugoslavia. Italy also had an interest in this area of Europe, controlled Albania, and shared influence in adjoining countries with her German ally. Finland, Hungary, Romania, and Bulgaria were also allied with Germany, and the Waffen-SS, regular military units within the SS, recruited troops all over Europe, particularly in the Baltic states, in the Ukraine, in Scandinavia, and in the Netherlands and Belgium. Norway, Denmark, the Netherlands, Belgium and much, later all, of France were occupied by the Germans. Sweden, Switzerland, Spain and Portugal remained neutral throughout the war. It is convenient to review, at this point, some matters pertaining to the SS, a strange bureaucracy, which had responsibility for certain improbable combinations of functions. Only three of these functions, security, concentration camp administration, and resettlement policies, are of interest in our study. The best-known agency of the SS was the RSHA, Reich Security Main Office, which embraced the Gestapo, secret state police, headed by SS Lieutenant General Heinrich Muller, the SD, security service, headed by SS Lieutenant General Schellenberg, the Kripo, criminal police, headed by SS Lieutenant Generals Neva and, later, Panzinger, and related functions. The first head of the RSHA had been SS General Reinhard Heydrich, an ambitious and ruthless young man whose methods generated many enemies for him. Ever since the Röhm Purge of 1934, the substantial ambitions of the SS in respect to military matters had resulted in growing conflict between the SS and the regular military establishment, the Wehrmacht, and Heydrich was not in the least bit delicate in the methods he employed to prosecute the conflict. In 1938, he had forced the resignation of the Minister of War, General Blomberg, by showing that Blomberg's new wife had been a prostitute. Blomberg's obvious successor was General von Fritsch, so Heydrich constructed a frame-up of von Fritsch, based on perjured allegations of homosexuality. Although von Fritsch was eventually exonerated, his career had been ruined, and the bitterness toward Heydrich swelled. The SS had a second basis for rivalry with the military establishment. The German intelligence services were the Abwehr, German military intelligence, responsible to the military high command and headed, since 1935, by Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, and the SD, the political intelligence arm, responsible to Heydrich and Himmler. Since the two types of intelligence activity cannot be strictly separated, Canaris and Himmler inevitably became rivals. Heydrich appears to have attempted to be cooperative with Canaris, at least at first. This may have been due to Heydrich's own background as a naval intelligence officer who, during the 20s, had served and trained under Canaris and had even been a frequent visitor to his home. More significantly, the admiral was a traitor. He is one of the awesome mysteries of World War II. During and even before the war, he was in contact with Churchill in 1938. Canaris betrayed Germany at every opportunity. A British official has expressed the role of Canaris most succinctly, quote, "We had Admiral Canaris," unquote. The man's motivations remain as mysterious as his personality and his antecedents. Ian Colvin, one of the authorities on World War II intelligence operations, wrote a whole book about Canaris and, yet, never deciphered him, quote, "The readers will have to judge for themselves whether Admiral Wilhelm Canaris was a German patriot or a British spy, a European statesman or a cosmopolitan intriguer, a double agent, an opportunist, or a seer. It will not be easy for them to make up their minds," unquote. It may be of some relevance that the man whom Colvin, in his 1951 book, characterized as one of Canaris's close personal friends, Otto John, the Opfer man in the all-important neutral capital of Lisbon during World War II, later became chief of state security for the Bonn government, and was subsequently exposed, in 1956, as a Soviet agent. The Canaris case is sometimes confused by grouping Canaris with the men behind the abortive coup d'état of July 20, 1944. This is utterly erroneous since Canaris used all his powers to betray Germany, whereas the men of July 20 merely betrayed Hitler, and would never have betrayed Germany. No Englishman, after the war, could have truthfully said, "We had Erwin Rommel." The most one can say about Canaris's involvement is that he was no doubt aware of the conspiracy in its early states, and naturally gave its members the impression that he was with them. Canaris was a grand master at giving such impressions. To return to Heydrich, great ambition had gotten the young SS general appointed deputy protector of Bohemia-Moravia in late 1941. He was thus starting to look bigger than his superior, Reichsfuhrer SS Heinrich Himmler. It might also be interesting to speculate that, at about this time, Heydrich may have started to grasp Canaris's game. As chief of the RSHA and as a former associate of Canaris, no man was better situated and motivated to penetrate Canaris's secret than Heydrich was. When one considers the long-burning antagonism of the army, it appears that Heydrich, by early 1942, had accumulated a very long list of powerful enemies in Germany. It was thus remarkable that at this point in Heydrich's career, the English, it is said, fortuitously removed him in May 1942 by dropping two assassins from the sky. In accord with the all-too-common scenario for political assassinations, for example the Abraham Lincoln and John F. Kennedy assassinations, the alleged assassins were said to have been killed before they got an opportunity to talk. In an appointment that caused general astonishment, Heydrich was succeeded in early 1943 by the relatively obscure and much less ambitious Dr. Ernst Kaltenbrunner. Evidently desirous of avoiding repetition of the situation that had developed with Heydrich, Himmler retained a rather more direct control of the Gestapo and the SD than he had held previously. However, both agencies continued to be formally responsible to the head of the RSHA, now Kaltenbrunner. Himmler also charged Kaltenbrunner with a special task, to build up the intelligence service of the SD. This was a particularly timely decision on the part of Himmler, since Canaris fell from power, without being fully exposed, in February 1944 and, by a special Hitler decree, all military and political intelligence functions were taken over by the RSHA, thus uniting all intelligence activity under SD Chief Schellenberg. Canaris was arrested after the July 20 coup, and he was executed shortly before the end of the war. Concentration camp administration was under the WVHA, Economic Administrative Main Office, headed by SS General Oswald Pohl. As its name suggests, the WVHA was concerned with the economic role of the SS which had arisen, for the most part, on account of the availability of the labor of concentration camp inmates. The commandants of the concentration camps reported to the Inspectorate of Concentration Camps, headed by SS Brigadier General Glucks, who reported to Pohl. Pohl reported to Himmler, and was formally equal in rank to Kaltenbrunner and Heydrich. It is convenient to state at this point, in very general terms, what was going on with respect to the Jews of Europe during the life of the Nazi regime. Before the war, the German government had used all means to encourage the emigration of Jews from Germany, and most German Jews had left Germany before the outbreak of the war. The persistent problems in connection with this emigration program were, first, the dislocations of the economy which were entailed in moving the Jews out and, second, the difficulty in arranging for other countries to take the Jews. By the summer of 1941, Germany was at war with Russia, and huge numbers of Jews, meaning the greater part of all the Jews of Europe, were in the German sphere of influence. However, the war had also opened up, temporarily, vast new territories for the Germans, and consequently, a program of Jewish resettlement got underway in the autumn of 1941. Through the course of the war, as long as Germany controlled any significant amount of eastern territory, European Jews were being resettled in the east. There were also a certain number of young adult Jews conscripted for labor. On account of certain political problems and the priority of war requirements, the resettlement program was only partially carried out and, of course, nowhere near 6 million Jews were involved. Excluding Polish and Romanian Jews, perhaps 750,000 Jews were resettled, primarily in the Ukraine, White Russia, and Latvia. Not all Polish Jews fell under German domination. Apart from those who managed to flee before or after the German occupation, several hundred thousand or perhaps a million Jews had been deported from Poland by the Russians in 1940, and had been dispersed in the Soviet Union. For the most part, the Polish Jews who came into German hands were crowded into ghettos in eastern Poland, 1939 boundaries. What happened to all of these people can be established only in a very general way, because all of the territory that the Jews had been resettled onto, became Soviet territory after the war, and because the victorious powers engaged in considerable suppression of the data. However, there is sufficient evidence to permit us to see approximately what happened. Although it is very likely that a fair number perished in the disorderly and chaotic conditions that accompanied the German retreats, it is established that a large number of Jews, predominantly of pre-war Polish nationality, were absorbed into the Soviet Union, and the remainder of the Jews who had been uprooted, ultimately resettled in Palestine, the US, Europe, and elsewhere. These general remarks are supplied here to serve as a background, to assist the reader in interpreting the analysis of the extermination claims, which is the task of the next few chapters. However, the major evidence for these remarks concerning what actually happened to the Jews will not be presented until Chapter 7. The RSHA was responsible for carrying out most aspects of this Jewish policy. Within the Gestapo there was an office, before, which designated the, quote, Religions and Cults Division, Jewish Religion Subdivision, unquote, headed by one Karl Adolf Eichmann, whose highest attained rank had been Lieutenant Colonel or Colonel. Eichmann did the routine chores associated with the Jewish emigration and resettlement policies of the German government. Most of his time was spent arranging with the various Jewish councils to draw up transport lists of Jews, and arranging for transportation for the deportees. There is no evidence that Eichmann ever participated in formulating policy, and since he was not involved in concentration camp administration, he could not have been directly involved in whatever it was that happened in those camps. It is, therefore, quite ridiculous that it was possible to get so many people excited about the case of a person such as Eichmann, who had performed completely routine functions in Nazi Germany. Those functions were carried out in accordance with specific orders transmitted by his superiors. His Jerusalem testimony was given, quote, after consulting Reitlinger and Polyakov, producing 17 multicolored charts, which contributed little to a better understanding of the bureaucratic machinery of the Third Reich, unquote. I see no point in viewing the Eichmann affair as anything but a publicity stunt on the part of a state, accustomed to disregarding the constraints that other states feel bound to respect. A short discussion of the Eichmann case and of Eichmann's Jerusalem testimony is provided in Chapter 6, pages 243 and 4th following of the print edition. Other departments of the SS, which were involved in resettlement activities were the RKFDV, Reich Commission for the Strengthening of Germandom, headed by SS General Ulrich Greifeld, the RU-SHA, Race and Settlement Main Office, headed by SS Generals Otto Hoffmann and, later, Richard Hildebrandt, and the VOMI, Liaison Office for Ethnic Germans, headed by SS General Werner Lawrence. The most important responsibility of these departments was the resettlement of ethnic Germans on conquered territories, and Greifeld was the main personality in this program. However, they inevitably got involved in the program of Jewish resettlement to some degree.